Yeah. All right, she isn't anorectic anymore. And she is, she's probably about 8 years out now, and which is remarkable for anorectics. I mean, I can remember running into her sister. Oh, yes, and her sister, the one that thought I was crazy, she's an ANCT certified counselor now. And I remember running into her and asking her how her sister was doing and feeling just a little bit uneasy about it, because, I mean, you know, you sort of expect that folks who are anorectic might get back into it. And she was doing just fine. She was doing fine 8 years later. She is married a Christian man that worked with her in Awana. You know, she was involved in ministry at her church. She continues, last I heard, to work, and she was working as a home health care aide, which sort of went along with helping little old ladies. The first client that the company sent her out to work with was a 90-year-old woman that she took care of for 2 weeks. And in that 2 weeks, she was able to share the gospel with that woman. The woman prayed to receive Christ as her Savior and promptly died. And she came back later to get the durable equipment that the company had there to take care of the woman with, and ran into the family who was cleaning out the house. The family were Christian people, and they were somewhat depressed because they thought Aunt Hazel had died and busted hell wide open, you know, because they did not know that she was a Christian or had become one. And she had the privilege of telling them how she shared the gospel with their loved one, and how that woman prayed to receive Christ as her Savior. I tell you, that's a remarkable story when you think about it, because that woman was nearly dead the first time I talked to her, and the last time I heard of her, she was leading people to Christ. So, you know, the gospel is powerful. All right, let's talk about medicine. I think I talked with her probably around 12 to 16 times. I would say it was probably about 12. I think I went through, yes, 12, which is kind of remarkable in and of itself, because you usually don't talk to people for that short a length of time with this kind of problem. It's usually forever. And I can remember when she left, she brought us some presents, and it was candy. You know, yeah, you know, what would an anorectic value most? Candy. And then I can remember giving this lecture up at Lafayette, and being a little behind as I was this evening, and there was a nice young lady sitting with her husband right about there, and getting towards the end, she starts raising her hand and wants to say something, and I'm behind, so I'm doing what any good speaker would do. It's like, can you just wait a little bit? I'll get to you, you know, because I need to get to the end of the lecture. And finally, she just blurted out and said, "That's my aunt." And I stood there for a minute because, you know, waiting for the other shoe to drop, you know. And she said, "And she's doing fine." And I went, "Ah, good." And then she said, "And they sold the donut shop." So, all right, now onwards to medicine, actual medication. And I can tell you this about pharmacology, which is what we're talking about here. It was in my second semester, my wife thought it was going to kill me to finish the course. It was a 5-hour grad course, and it was 15 hours at least a week for me to study. And I can't condense that into 45 minutes. There just isn't any way. So I'm going to give you a real overview, and we're going to look at drugs that are used in depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, ADHD, and schizophrenia. And I hope you brought a cup of coffee with you. Let's go. All right, starting, psychotropic drugs, what are they? Now, there are 7 things that you might want to know about this, all right? If you had these questions kind of floating around in your mind when you're talking to somebody about whatever medications they're on, these would be helpful. The first question is, what is this drug that the doctor has given blank? You know, my relative, my counselee, my loved one, my friend, what exactly is this? Question 2, how's it supposed to help? You know, how is this supposed to help my blank blanks? Situation. 3, Will it affect the counseling process? And if it will, how? You know, how is it going to affect my ability to talk to this person? And then, will this medicine prevent someone from growing and changing and become more like Christ? Now, that's a tough question to ask a counselee and a doctor, but you can kind of nose, or you know, the doctor who gives it, but you can kind of nose around and out on the edges. If it's like Mirapex, we won't talk about Mirapex tonight. It's a restless leg drug. Actually, it's an anti-Parkinsonian drug. And it's really famous because if you listen to the Mirapex commercials, which promise relief from restless leg syndrome, when they do that gear shift thing that I told you about where they lower their voice and start talking fast, they start talking about strange things, about aggressive sexuality and gambling. And the reason why is because they've had some old guys who've been taking Mirapex for restless leg syndrome, and the wife comes home one day and the moving van is taking all their stuff and their house has been sold because the old guy has, unknown to her, gambled away everything that they have, period. And or she finds out that he's been chasing all the women on the block, you know, sexually, literally. And when they stop taking Mirapex, they quit doing those things. So, you know, interesting side effect. All right. So will this medicine, question five, will some of the behavior that I must deal with be caused by the medicine? Six, is it right or wrong to take this medicine? You know, and then seven, is the benefit of the medicine worth the side effects? That is the most important question. That and question two, how is it supposed to help? And what are the side effects? Those are the two most important things that you want to know out of medication. Now, what is a psychotropic drug? It's a substance that is intended to have its primary action on the central nervous system by altering activity in the brain with the goal of changing thinking, emotion, and behavior. Other definitions. What are neurotransmitters? These drugs are drugs that are used by physicians to treat depression, anxiety, and a host of acronym-labeled problems. And in the last 10 years, the use of antidepressants in the United States, in spite of the fact that it has been known since 1998, you know that original study that I told you about that's cited in the Newsweek article? This information has been known since 1998. And from 1998 to year 2000 to 2010, the response of American medicine has been that the number of people who are taking antidepressants has doubled. You know, in spite of the fact that there is this, you know, unquieting voice standing behind us asking the question, does this stuff really work? The number of prescriptions continue to grow. Now, neurotransmitters are chemicals in the central nervous system that are believed to be involved in the control of personality, mood, eating, temperature, sleep, wakefulness. They include serotonin, 5-hydroxytryptamine. The lady who discovered it in snails first. I think her name was Taurog or something like that. She's still alive. It's really an interesting story. And then dopamine, norepinephrine and dopamine are produced from tyrosine through similar pathways in the nerve terminals. All right. Other definitions you need to know. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Boy, that's a mouthful. And what that means is that these are medicines that are supposed, and that is, you know, that is the word, supposed, because no one really knows, to inhibit the reuptake of serotonin into brain nerve cells, thereby increasing the available serotonin to stimulate serotonin receptors. Nobody actually knows if these drugs actually do that. There's a good article published in PLOS Medicine. I would encourage you to go look at plosmedicine.org. That's the Public Library of Science Medicine, and it's plosmedicine.org. And in a search, just type in serotonin, you know, or depression or whatever, and it'll pop you up a ton of articles. Or direct consumer advertising, it'll pop you up a ton of articles about all these things. And they're mostly the kind of articles that could only get published in a journal that doesn't take money from a drug company. You know, that this is the only place they're going to get published. And in that, there's an article that talks about how do these drugs actually work? And what the author of this article said that, you know, it may very well be that these drugs don't do anything to serotonin, but actually they don't actually correct anything. That is certainly a myth. But that they induce an abnormal state in the brain that the person who takes it likes better than the way they felt when they weren't taking it. You know, that may be the mechanism of action, if there is one, as far as we know. All right. Tricyclic and tetracyclic antidepressants are older drugs like Elavil and Triavil, and they're believed to increase the level of norepinephrine and serotonin, and thereby increase available norepinephrine to stimulate norepinephrine receptors. And if you think you're going to sleep while you're, stand up. That's what we always used to do in medical school. You know, it's like, if you think you're going to pass out while I'm talking about this stuff, just stand up. The tricyclic tetracyclic antidepressants are amitriptyline, amoxapine, and doxepin, and imipramine. Their mechanism of action is unknown. And that is going to be a repetitive statement. I'll be saying that over and over and again tonight. Mechanism of action is unknown. Assumed to work by changing levels of norepinephrine and serotonin. Now, what are the side effects that limit the use? Well, in tricyclic and tetracyclic antidepressants, the side effects that limit use are weight gain, dry mouth, sedation, and cardiac rhythm problems. The cardiac rhythm problems are a big enough deal that if you have heart trouble, you won't be taking Elavil generally. People don't want to prescribe it because of it. We used to make jokes about the weight gain with Elavil. You think about it. You're sitting there and you're sitting across the desk from a depressed woman. Because usually, you know, when Elavil came out, about the only people who actually went to doctors during the day were women, and most of the people who were depressed were women. Now, I don't know why that's the case, but the preponderance works in that direction. And so you smile at them and you say, here, you take this drug, you'll probably gain 25 pounds. You won't be able to stay awake during the day, and your mouth will get real dry. Now, we always used to think that, honestly, that if I gave that to any number of women, that I would probably start to have to drive different ways home at night, because eventually one of them would be standing along the road to shoot me because they'd gained, you know, they were depressed already and they gained 25 pounds. Uses of Elavil still yet today that are actually that have some benefit are chronic pain problems like diabetic neuropathies. These drugs do seem to help diabetics who have a leg pain from diabetes and insomnia. You know, if you ask me, what are you going to give people who can't sleep? Well, I'm going to probably try to avoid anything that's very habit forming, and Elavil is not real habit forming because it's really not any fun to take. Period. And we'll talk about fun to take in a minute. Now, selective depression and disorders, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. These include Celexa, Lexapro, which Lexapro is just a derivative of Celexa that was derived because the patent ran out on Celexa. And if you switch an isomer in Celexa, it becomes Lexapro, and you can patent it and sell it as a brand name drug instead of for $4 at Walmart or Kroger. Prozac and Luvox, Paxil and Zoloft, these are all come out of the same family. The mechanism of action for serotonin reuptake inhibitors is unknown. Yes, you can. You know, I can just stop the sentence and let you guys. It's like the preacher's asking for an amen or something, isn't it? Yes. It is assumed to work by changing the levels of serotonin, as we've said earlier. Now, what are the side effects of SSRIs? You know, when they showed up to detail us for selective, you know, for Prozac, you could have thought we were giving people distilled water, you know, from what they told us. Almost no side effects. And part of the real important aspect of the success of Prozac, which Prozac was billions and billions of dollars, was because they would tell family doctors that a patient can't kill themselves with this. Now, see, Elavil, if you gave someone 30 days of Elavil, you would never give someone who was depressed 30 days of Elavil. Why? Because they could go home, take all 30 days worth of it, and they would be dead. It would kill them. Quite on the other hand, I would smile and look at the patient and say, I can remember when Prozac first came out, I would smile, look at them and say, and oh, by the way, if you're thinking about killing yourself, don't take these pills. All it will do is inconvenience you. You can't kill yourself by taking all 30 days worth. And with that, then, what Lilly did was in effect, take the control over who got Prozac away from psychiatrists. You see, if Lilly had to depend upon psychiatrists to write Prozac, they'd have never made $1 billion. And the reason why they would never have made $1 billion is because there are not enough psychiatrists to go around. But they could go convince every family doctor in the country that depression is a real disease and this medicine cures it. And if you give it to someone, they can't hurt themselves with it. And then the market opened up like crazy. So much so that just about every family doctor, internist, and gynecologist in the country knows how to write for Prozac and doesn't have any particular bad feeling about doing it. Now, what are the side effects, though? Because I can remember a Lexapro detailer. And it's really kind of sad, too, because when I started practicing medicine, the guys who came around to talk to us, they were pharmacists. They sent registered pharmacists out to talk to us. By the time, I don't see too many of them anymore because they don't bother to talk to me because I don't write for their prescriptions much. You know, they can come through and they can detail me and they can leave and then they can go down to the drugstore and check. And, it's like they're wasting their time. But I can remember probably about 10 years ago, a Lexapro a rep came through and she looked at me. She was young. She was probably 22. She was probably a business graduate at least. And she looked at me and said, Lexapro doesn't have any side effects. And I just, I'm just like, oh my, you are so stupid. And I didn't say that to her, but she was. Why? Because there's no drug on the face of the earth that doesn't have side effects if it actually does anything, one. And two, I knew for sure that these antidepressants would have side effects, and they do, all of them. Included in it is weight gain. What's really kind of amusing is when we started out with Prozac, we initially gave it to people because we thought they'd lose weight. That was a joke. Everybody who takes Prozac for 5 years usually gains 20 to 25 pounds on it. So there's weight gain, suicidal ideation. People who take these medicines are at risk to think about killing themselves and think about it only because they're taking the drug, period. It is the drug that changes their thinking. This doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. And when I write prescriptions for any of them, I always warn the patient, if you start having abnormal thinking, and that's also why I make them come in every 3 months, and they don't like that, but I tell them, if you start having abnormal thinking, do not think you're having a bad day. You know, it could very well be the medicine that's the source of your bad thinking. And then there are sexual dysfunction problems. While these drugs are used to treat anxiety, anxiety itself can be a side effect of the medicine. So much so that Zoloft tried to play itself off against Paxil, against Prozac, because Prozac at 20 milligrams, if you just start it right up, makes you jump all over the place. Just makes you jump. It's crazy. And so much so that Eli Lilly started making 10 milligram capsules and giving them away so that doctors would give 10 milligrams for the first week or two so that patients wouldn't have this adverse reaction. So anxiety can be a side effect, along with a phenomenon called akathisia, which means I can't sit still. I just, I feel like I have to be in motion. I have to keep doing something, and sometimes tremors. The effectiveness rates are down in the 25% for these drugs. Next drug is Wellbutrin. Familiar? It is considered to be a norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, and a dopamine norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. Its mechanism of action is unknown. Yes, unknown. It is assumed to work by raising dopamine and norepinephrine in the brain. This drug certainly shouldn't be given to people who are anxious because it can increase anxiety and agitation, and it's not supposed to be used in people who have seizures. Its effectiveness is not any greater than any of the SSRIs, so it's down in the 25 to 30% range, and the placebo asterisk applies to it as well. Now, there are some novel uses for it. All these drugs actually have little novel uses. And smoke cessation. They found that people who took Wellbutrin, it affected their how they like to smoke. It made their cigarettes taste bad. It also would do chocolate about the same way. So it got repackaged as Zyban. I don't know if you've heard of that or not, but all Zyban is Wellbutrin. All right, selective serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors. These include Cymbalta, Effexor, and Pristiq. Mechanism of action is, that's right, but it's believed to be elevating levels of serotonin and norepinephrine. Actually, all Cymbalta is a throwback to Elavil. Elavil was the original probable norepinephrine serotonin drug. And when they went back to Cymbalta, all they did was put norepinephrine reuptake back into the mix. And the side effects are similar to the SSRIs, but worse. There are all kinds of warnings about drug interactions that go along with Cymbalta. And early on, I live in Indianapolis, so the home of Eli Lilly. And there was an 18-year-old girl who was in a clinical study there on the Eli Lilly campus. A college student was, you enroll in these studies, you get paid, you stay, you take the drug, they do blood samples, ask you questions. And on a Saturday, she hung herself. She had never had a suicidal thought in her life that anybody knew of. She had never been depressed. So they always, when they start talking really, they lower their voice and start talking fast in the Cymbalta commercials, they always say, can't be used in people under 18. Effectiveness is similar to the SSRIs. A novel use for Cymbalta, one which for which it actually might work but which they couldn't make $1 billion selling it, is, again, for chronic pain for diabetics. Neuropathic pain, Cymbalta does seem to help. Then there are serotonin modulators. Boys, aren't you guys glad you signed up for the pharmacology course now? I don't think so. Trazodone and Cerazone, these may be familiar to you. Their mechanism of action has to do with serotonin modulation, but is unknown, that's right. Now, the side effects include sleepiness for trazodone, which gets its probably its biggest use in the United States is for insomnia. That's generally what trazodone gets prescribed for. People will be taking Paxil or Effexor or something like that, and they'll slap on 100 milligrams of trazodone at night so they can sleep. All right, then there are monoamine oxidase inhibitors, which you don't need to know anything about because almost nobody prescribes them. The reason why is because you can eat the wrong cheese or drink the wrong wine and your blood pressure will go to 250 over 170 or something like that and you'll have a stroke. Yeah, it's a hypertensive crisis. So not very many, no family practice physician or general internist would write for these. The only people you'll find writing them for are psychiatrists and they don't use it much. Now, moving on to the atypical antipsychotics, which are being promoted for depression. Now, why are atypical antipsychotics getting promoted for depression? Anybody want to venture a guess? Why? What? Well, no, there's plenty of problems with them. It has to, huh? Profitable. Yes, it would be very profitable if every depressed person in the country took Abilify, at least 5 milligrams. They'd make $1 billion a year out of it. But why would they need to take Abilify?
The original drug's
exactly. Now that's exactly it right there. You're only getting, and that's how the advertisement goes. Have you seen the advertisement on television? Yeah. It's like, Abilify has now been approved by the FDA, which of course tells the person who's watching television that this is a real disease and that the drug is effective. That occurred in about 1960. It's an interesting phenomenon. The FDA became the people who decide if diseases are real and if drugs work. Up till about 1960, that was not in their purview. It's just an interesting quirk in history. But Abilify has been approved because, only about 35% of the people who take antidepressants get better. And they think maybe another 5% people get better if they take Abilify. Now, how would you know if the Abilify did anything? It would really be tough, wouldn't it? Yeah, why? Because you have a person who's hopeless, they're taking medicine, they're not getting any better, and you tell them, if you take this second drug, you'll get better. So guess what happens? The placebo effect begins to apply on the outcomes of the study all over again. Now, why wouldn't I prescribe Abilify to a depressed person? Well, the mechanism of action is Right. Nobody knows why it should help with an antidepressant, because it's not an antidepressant. It's actually a major tranquilizer. Well, let's look at the side effects. How about weight gain? I have a friend. Weight gain is really a bad thing, isn't it? Particularly if you're depressed. I have a friend whose child was who diagnosed with autism and was placed on Abilify, may have had some hallucinations or something like that. Hard to say. But the family thought they were going to have to buy thicker doors for the kitchen cabinets and padlocks, because this kid would eat everything that he saw. He gained 25 pounds in a month. Kaboom. Now, you know, I always tell people, if you're going to take that drug, you should understand you're probably going to gain weight. Now, the drug itself will not make you stick the Twinkies in your mouth, but it probably does alter the way you think about food in such a way that you're going to feel like you really do want to go out there and eat another one of those chocolate no-bake cookies, even though you're right up to about here, you know, stuffed. And so this is not just, it may work a little bit like prednisone. Prednisone will do about the same thing. People who chronically take prednisone will balloon up, and their appetites, they'll tell you, are ravenous. So weight gain is a huge problem. Thereby, diabetes is a huge problem, because, you know, if you want to become a type 2 diabetic, gain 50 pounds. You know, you'll find your way into type 2 diabetes pretty quickly. The next thing is a little frightening. It's called tardive dyskinesia. That's where you develop movements and tics that you can't stop and may become permanent. You know, it's like sitting here and jerking all the time, about like this. I know it might look a little funny. I can remember sitting in an airport and seeing a guy doing it, and it wasn't Tourette's, it was more than that. So these drugs have the potential to cause tardive dyskinesia. Then they sedate people. They cause Parkinsonian-like problems, like you have Parkinson's disease with the flat affect and the inhibited motion. They can cause cardiac arrhythmias. They cause a fatal illness called neuromalignant syndrome, where your body loses its ability to regulate your temperature, and you're in a temperature 105, 107, and it kills you. And people who take these kind of drugs are more likely to kill themselves, period. You know, if you look at folks who take the atypical antipsychotics, they are more likely to kill themselves. Effectiveness, of course, is difficult to assess. Now, what do we use to treat anxiety with? Well, probably the most commonly prescribed thing for anxiety today is an antidepressant. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? And they will be selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And the reasoning behind that, and I understand the reasoning very well, is that the most popular drug that we're going to talk about in a moment for anxiety is a diazepam derivative. You know, a Valium, a Ativan, a Klonopin, Xanax. Those are the popular ones, and they're addictive. And so most of us don't like to write people prescriptions to chronically use something that we know if they use it for a couple of months, they will be addicted, period. And it's really not a matter of character, all right? It's sort of like OxyContin in a sense. You know, people look at folks who are OxyContin addicts and we think that they must have bad character. No, all they have to do is take OxyContin for 2 months. You don't have to have bad character. You can be rich, famous, and have no reason to want to be trying to get drugs out of anybody. And if somebody puts you on it for some reason and you get to take it for a couple of months, you have a potential to be addicted, a significant potential to be addicted. And it's the same is true for the anti-anxiety drugs. So instead, we write for Zoloft. Now, the other side of it, too, is that Zoloft isn't any fun to take. There is no euphoria associated with it, which is the other issue. Buspar is an SSRI that we didn't talk about, and it is a moderately effective drug, I suppose, for anxiety, but it's not liked. And people who have taken Xanax or Ativan for long periods of time, they won't find it useful, because the aspect of the drug that makes them want to take Ativan and Xanax won't be there, and that's the buzz or the euphoria. Benzodiazepine derivatives. These became very popular in the 1960s. They actually replaced a drug called Miltown. And Miltown was enormously popular in the United States in like the late 1950s up until the early 1960s. It was so popular that drugstores would, if they would run out of it, and they would put a sign on the door saying "No Milltown today." And the joke used to be it was Milltown and Milton. Now, do you know who Milton Berle was? Yeah, he had a television show. It was on Friday night, and they would go to the drugstore, get their Milltown, go home, drink a cocktail, take their Milltown, get their buzz, and sit down and watch Milton Berle. And that just a funny part of history. But the Valium derivatives, they cleaned Milltown out. You know that, and it became Milltown. Actually, I think survives today as Soma. You know, another drug that becomes difficult because if people take it for any period of time, they'll be looking for various and sundry different people to prescribe it. All right. The benzodiazepam derivatives are Xanax, Valium, lorazepam, Clonopin, and a host of others. And these drugs lower CNS nerve excitability, we believe. In sufficient doses, they cause unconsciousness and amnesia, which is exactly what you want if you're having a colonoscopy. You want some Versed, yes. Give me 50 of Demerol and 3 or 4 of Versed, please. And that way, when you wake up 2 hours later, you won't remember a thing. The side effects include sedation and addiction, and the effectiveness of them, while they do calm people down, is that with regular use, there is a phenomenon called tachyphylaxis. You can start out at 0.5 milligram of, or 0.25 Xanax, and be taking 1 milligram 4 times a day in no time at all, because, you know, for a while the 0.25 works 3 or 4 times a day, but then it's not working so well. You go back to the doctor, he writes for 0.5, and then you're taking it 4 times a day. And then pretty soon you go back, it's not working, so you're up to 1 milligram. And it just boom, 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 just like that. And my advice is don't start. You know, people ask me, how do you not get addicted to Ativan, Xanax, and lorazepam and all that kind of stuff? Don't start. That's the easiest way not to get addicted. I write prescriptions for like 15, you know, and I'll smile and say, you know, you're not going to get addicted to this if I write it, because I'm not going to refill it. You know, I'll help you now for a short period of time. Somewhat useful in people who are actually have mania at the time. You know, useful to sort of sedate or calm them down during mania, and useful in the short term. You know, as I said, if someone comes in and they've lost a loved one and they are beside themselves, it's not that I want to disconnect the grieving process, but it's probably best that they sleep, you know. And so I'll arrange for them to be able to take something at night and sleep. Good night's sleep helps a lot of things. Now we're to the ADHD drugs, amphetamines. Okay. No, now's a great time. It depends on what they're addicted to and what your level of training is. Now, those are the two things. People who are addicted to medicines like the diazepam derivatives, if they're taking a real boatload of diazepam, if they're like on 1 milligram of Xanax 4 times a day, if they stop suddenly, they can seize. They can seize just because they stop it. So they need to be, I would say, reasonably, people who are addicts need to be in care where someone who is familiar with detoxifying them can help them work their way down and off of it. I have helped some people who are narcotic addicted, like Vicodin addicts and things like that, as an outpatient, because the potential for bad outcomes is very small. But I would say in biblical counseling, if you have someone and they're there because they are an addict and they are still using, probably, their next step is they're going to need to be someplace where someone who is very familiar with detoxifying people is going to take care of them.
So is our call to the doctor then? Is that who would make that judgment about whether?
Yes, you could do that. That would be a reasonable thing. Or you could go talk to the detox centers around town in your area and tell them, look, we do counseling. We believe at some point in time we may see people who are addicted, and what are your services that are available to them? You know, that would be another way to do it. In Indianapolis, the Salvation Army runs the Harbor Light Center, and they detox patients. They have to be relatively stable, you know, so they have to have a doctor say that, you know, they're not going to die going through detox, but, you know, they're familiar with what they do. So that's what I would say about that. All right. Okay, amphetamines, drugs for ADHD. These include Adderall, Adderall XR, methylphenidate SR, Ritalin, Methylin, Metadate, CD, Concerta, Focalin, Daytrona patches, Desidrine, Adderall, and Lisdexamfetamine. These also include drugs for weight loss, which are Phentermine, Adipex. We're doing okay on the notes, aren't we? I'm not skipping ahead, or you're not missing anything. Okay. All right. The weight loss drugs, the amphetamine weight loss drugs, in my opinion, are worthless. The reason why they're worthless is because nobody takes them and keeps weight off. You know, if you start at ground zero and you treat them for 90 days, which is what the FDA limits the use of phentermine to, although you can go a lot of places and people will keep you on it for a year or longer, which is beyond me why they would do it. But if they stick with the 90-day model and you come back a year later, you know, the weight regain phenomena is terrible. And the reason why is because they really don't learn how to change their lives in any substantial way that will help them lose and keep their weight off. So, these are central nervous system stimulants, and they work by causing the release of dopamine and norepinephrine, we assume. The original one was benzedrine, which the reason why it was invented and which was originally used, it was for pilots. And it was the pilots who were flying from London and Berlin and back. And they had to stay awake for, you know, 36 hours. I mean, it took a long time at 300 miles an hour. I forget how long, but it was a long way to fly a plane there and a long way to fly it back. And they would take dexedrine in order to do that. Now, the problem after the war was what? We had all these guys walking around who had been taking dexedrine through World War II are now addicts looking for dexedrine. And that was the first warning that it wasn't going to be a great thing. And then the next was when it was originally marketed for depression. You know, I think back in about the 1950s, people were trying to market it for depression, and they found out very quickly that it was a habit-forming problem and that it had significant adverse side effects. Even though it did seem to raise people's moods, side effects include addiction, seizures, sudden cardiac death. Now, that's a big one. Tachycardia, insomnia, Tourette's, which are the involuntary tics, anger, anxiety, aggression, psychosis, mania, and growth retardation. All those are side effects of amphetamines, which are commonly given to children in school today. The sad part of it that I see is not only do they get that, they usually end up on Seroquel. You know, kids in grade school end up on Seroquel, sometimes on Clonidine. And, you know, you ask, well, why are they on Seroquel and Clonidine? Well, because of the side effects of the amphetamines. I can remember having a kid come in up at Lafayette, and his problem was that he wanted to beat his mother up. And he was on Adderall and Risperdal. He was on Adderall because he could not function well in a classical classroom setting. And then he was on Risperdal because of the side effects of the Adderall. And it was really interesting because what we did, we sort of played it along until he got out of school. And then we sent him back to the pediatrician and said, would you please let him come off of it? And the pediatrician objected but did it. And what we found out is that kid had a personality. I mean, it was an amazing thing. He was a nice kid underneath the effects of the amphetamine and the Risperdal. And he didn't do classroom settings very well, but he also, after that, didn't want to beat his mother up all the time either. Effectiveness of these drugs depends on what your goal is in life. The studies of the use of amphetamines in education, which look as the endpoint improvement in academic performance, you will not find a study published that says that if people take this medicine, their grades will get better. And that's out of UpToDate, which is a journal review service that I subscribe to. In other words, if the kid's going to get A's and he takes Adderall, he'll get A's. If he's going to get B's, he'll get B's. If he's going to get C's, he'll get C's. The real use of it, I think, is to somehow force boys to fit into an educational model that really doesn't apply to them. And I say that in all kindness, and I'm not trying to be controversial. I just mean that. Most of the behavior which is identified in life as ADHD is normal boyhood behavior. And I would, when it gets down to, I don't write for these. These I will not write for. I won't write for them for adults. I won't write for them for kids unless I am covering for somebody who does. And sometimes I get stuck in that and I have to write a prescription for somebody who's taking it because my partner writes for it. And but myself, I won't do it. And the reason why I won't do it is because I think the side effects are tremendous. And the long-term adverse effects are not good, and I don't think it's wise. I don't think that the side effect profile is justified by the benefit. So I would urge you to get a book, if you're interested in this, beyond what I can say tonight, by Leonard Sachs, S-A-X, Leonard. And it is Boys Adrift, and it's an excellent book about what the outcome is of treating boys with amphetamines for the last 30 years in the United States has been. It has something to do with boys who are 35 years old and still in the parents' basement playing a computer game. Yeah, something about the failure to launch thing. Addiction and abuse among children is on the rise for amphetamines. And how much addiction and how much abuse goes on is directly correlated to how much we write. The more prescriptions we write for this, the more abuse and addiction problems we see. Strattera is a non-amphetamine drug for the treatment of ADHD. It was developed from a failed norepinephrine antidepressant, and it's supposed to theoretically work about the same way amphetamines do. Amphetamines kick out norepinephrine, and Strattera is supposed to be a norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. The side effects for Strattera are liver failure, and in a small number of children, sudden cardiac death, really big side effect if it's your kid. There is a reported increased risk of suicide and aggression, and for psychosis and mania, which we would expect from an SSRI antidepressant, since we see that as well in the adult population. And again, effectiveness is in the eye of the beholder. And I really do mean that. If the way that amphetamines are determined to work for ADHD is by rating scales. And the phenomena that comes in is almost like placebo effect, and it's called rater bias. If you take a classroom of kids, some of whom are labeled with ADHD and who are being treated and have been identified by the teacher and the parent and treated by the doctor, and you don't identify them in the class population, and you put a blind rater, someone who doesn't know who the kids are in the classroom, who have ADHD and who don't, and you rate them, all the kids in the classroom, pre and post-treatment, what is generally found is that there's no difference in their behavior. Blind raters do not see a difference in the behavior of children who are treated with ADHD. If you have the teacher rate them and the parents rate them, they will universally say that the behavior is improved. And what that is a sort of a backhand placebo effect. Except it's not the child who's getting the placebo, it is the rater who's getting the placebo, which would be the parent and the teacher. Moving on to bipolar disorder. Take a deep breath, we'll keep pressing on. We're doing all right, it's only 8:30. Lithium carbonate, the main drug for bipolar disorder. When I say bipolar disorder, I mean manic depression. Bipolar disorder 1, not bipolar disorder 2 and all the rest, not hypomania, not cyclothymia, but manic depression. Actually, lithium citrate, Coca-Cola used to contain cocaine. you know, early on in the late 1800s, early 1900s, well, 7-Up until 1950 used to contain lithium citrate. You know, it was part of whatever they made the clear, bubbly, no caffeine stuff with. Lithium is a naturally occurring metal originally used to dissolve bladder stones by John Cade. I think it was in Australia, and he found that it calmed rats down, and then he somehow managed to move that over to humans. You know, back in the 1950s, the structure for research wasn't nearly as tight as it is today, trust me. Mechanism of action is unknown, but assumed to work on overactive receptors, and, you know, the really truth of the matter is we don't know why it works. We just know that in people who actually have mania, which means they stay up for 2 weeks at a time, may see things that don't exist, hear things that nobody else hears, who believe that they are the objects of conspiracies, who spend $30,000 a week trying to buy West 38th Street. People like that seem to do better when they take lithium than when they don't. Side effects of lithium include renal damage, hypothyroidism, tremors, hair loss, rashes, ataxia, fatigue, and boy, that sounds bad. But I'll tell you, the rest of the drugs that they treat it with today, when you read the side effects on them and you start to say, well, maybe lithium's not so bad. It is effective in preventing recurring episodes in mania in people who are known to have recurring episodes. And you really have to watch somebody with mania to know that for a while. The average person who has manic episodes will usually only have one about every 2 years, whether you treat them or not. That's the natural course of the disease outside of treatment. It is being off-label used in post-traumatic stress disorder, and the reason why I know that is because I watched the vets come through over at the VA and see their diagnoses and their medication lists. It is now being used for aggressive behavior in children and conduct disorders in children, and I think that is an abomination. Should not be done. All right, further in bipolar disorder are the atypical antipsychotics. These you may be familiar with because of commercials. These include Zyprexa, which is big Eli Lilly drug. Eli Lilly really got creamed over this because they detailed it beyond what the FDA indications were, and it got back to the FDA, and so I think they got to pay, you know, $1.5 million fine over it or something like that. And then they also settled a lot of lawsuits about weight gain and diabetes. The atypical antipsychotics include Risperdal, Zyprexa, Seroquel. Seroquel is probably the more popularly used drug today. Gets used for a lot of things that aren't bipolar. And then Geodon and Abilify. The mechanism of action, again, is not known. They are derivatives of what we call the major tranquilizers, and they come from Thorazine, the original schizophrenia drug that came out in about the middle 1960s. That's the group they come out. Now, side effects of these drugs include obesity, diabetes, high cholesterol and triglycerides, increased risk of suicide, tardive dyskinesia, weight gain, mental slowing, and somnolence. These drugs are effective in controlling mania, and they are used in people who are called bipolar but don't have mania, and at that, that is the point at which I really draw the line. It's when you leave manic depression or bipolar 1, and then everybody else that you want to say has bipolar 2, you start putting them on these drugs. At that point, I start saying that the side effect profiles greatly outweigh the benefits to the individual who takes the drug. All right, the important problem with these drugs is increased risk of suicide, period. People who take these drugs are more likely to kill themselves than people who do not. They are far more likely to kill themselves than people who take lithium. If you're really interested in reducing the suicide rate among people who are called bipolar or manic depressive, they should be taking lithium, because lithium reduces the suicide rate by 45%. These drugs increase it. Then there are the anti-epileptic drugs that are also used in bipolar disorder, and these include Tegretol, Depakote, and Lamictal. Lamictal is, you know, it's probably a useful drug in people who cannot tolerate lithium, and some people can't. Some people, the side effects just drive them to distraction. My experience with this is that none of these drugs are really well tolerated and that people don't like to take them. And you really have to work with folks in order for them to continue to take them. The anti-epileptic drugs in this situation are called mood stabilizers. That is a name invented by the drug companies because there's nothing to say that they stabilize anything. It just seems like people who take these drugs, they are a little slower than everybody else. And that's exactly it. It slows people down. That's the reason why people who are epileptic don't like to take them. Folks who have epilepsy don't like to take these drugs. And the reason why is because it slows them down intellectually. Side effects are important and include suicide. There is an increased risk of suicide for anybody who takes these anti-epileptic drugs, period. For whatever reason, if you take it for bipolar disorder, if you take it because somebody thinks you have a bad mood all the time, or if you take it because you have seizures, there is a known increased risk of suicide for this. Also, there's intellectual slowing, and then there's a fatal, I think it's Stevens-Johnson syndrome, fatal skin disease. You break out in a rash with these, you stop the medicine immediately and go see the doctor. And then some people do develop liver dysfunction. All right. Then the benzodiazepines get used in bipolar disorder on short-term basis when people come in and they're manic. You know, when they're manic and they're hard to control and hard to calm down, then you give them these the Valium and Ativan, Xanax, and Klonopin. And we talked about the side effects of benzodiazepines, so we won't stop there. Now, we're to schizophrenia. We're moving right along. Ugh. Like I told you, pharmacology is a hard subject. Hard to stay awake. Atypical antipsychotics. We already talked about those. Those are actually the drugs that get used the most for schizophrenia today. The Seroquels, the Zyprexas. And for schizophrenics, they really, you know, when you consider what their life is like and how it's going to be for them, those are probably some of the better drugs to take. They have significant side effects, but then living as a schizophrenic who might think he's Jesus Christ and who sees things that aren't there, it's not a great way to live either. Clozapine is a drug that was looked to have a lot of promise in the 1990s, but it had a significant blood dyscrasia problem with it. People would have bone marrow suppression as a result, and so it fell out of favor, but it's now kind of moving its way back in because I think they have a better handle on what the bone marrow problems are, and it actually works, you know, better than the other drugs for schizophrenia. Old drugs that get used still are fluphenazine and Haldol. They are injectable. Mechanism of action is not clearly known, but they call these major tranquilizers, and that's what they do. The side effects of these drugs are considerable. They include dry mouth, flat expression, sedation, mental slowing, weight gain, tardive dyskinesia, Parkinson-like symptoms, tremors, and risk of suicide. You know, but you have to put it in the context that to have schizophrenia prior to about 1960 meant that you were going to live in a mental institution the rest of your life. That's what it meant. And I can tell you that the mental institutions that they lived in were as bad as the movies said. If you want to get a reference handle on it, go rent, if you can find it, The Snake Pit with Olivia de Havilland. You know, then you kind of get an idea of what was going on. All right. Okay, moving on. Now, is it right or wrong to take these medicines? Well, I kind of talked about that at the beginning of the hour from a Romans 14 viewpoint, but I'll tell you this about it. Judging is a risky business. That's what I would say. You know, if you look in Matthew 7, we get that passage where it tells us to judge not, lest we be judged. And generally speaking, when it tells us to do things like that, what it's trying to tell us is that we're making a judgment about something that we don't have all the answers for. You know, it's like when you're looking at someone and you're trying to make up your mind whether they're a believer or not, well, you don't have all the answer to that, and you're not going to have all the answer in this life. And so it doesn't pay to make a judgment about that. Why? Well, because that judgment is reserved to Christ, who has all the information. Then you go on to 1 Corinthians, and what is, I think it's 1 Corinthians 6, isn't it, or 2 Corinthians 6, where Paul is upbraiding the Corinthian church because they're suing each other out there in you know, down at the city courthouse. And he said, don't you have anybody inside your congregation who can judge? Well, there's an assumption there. The assumption is that before somebody makes a judgment, they're going to know both sides of the story, and they'll actually know the facts of the matter, and they'll be able to make a reasonable judgment. And then, when I get to the end of it all, I think of James 1, 12, and 13. When you're looking at people who are taking medicine, and you may not agree with them, or you may not agree with why they're doing it, or you may not agree with the doctor who's prescribing it, I always say, remember James 1, 12 through 13. Speak and act as those who've been judged by the law that gives liberty. Because judgment without mercy will be shown to those who are not merciful. Mercy triumphs over judgment. Now, there are aspects of these problems that we've been talking about tonight that we really, at this point in time, don't know all the facts to, and are not likely to in our lifetime. It's very possible. We may not understand schizophrenia or migraine headaches or bipolar disorder to a certainty in my lifetime. We might, it's possible, we may eventually discover the pathology. But we should certainly keep on looking, but we shouldn't be judgmental about people who are struggling with it. We ought to speak and act as those who got off the hook. That's what James 1:12 means. All right, that's the end of the lecture. We have 20 minutes for questions and or history.